Welcome everybody to today's meditation session. And as you see that we have visiting monk Venerajan Pasano, who's going to be leading the meditation today. Make for a change. But first, before we begin, as usual, if there's anyone here for the first time for the introduction to meditation class, the introduction to meditation class is being held on the room to my right over here. Between this room and the reception area, so if you're coming here for the first time, that's the place to go. Because on this ongoing course of meditation every Saturday afternoon, that we usually sit for about 40, 45 minutes. So it's a bit much for people just starting. And as usual, that the session will start with about 15 minutes of just general discussion about meditation. Then a meditation led by Venerajan Pasano, who was also at Wat Pa Phong under Ajahn Chah for the last 32 years. He's 1 year senior to me. We met at Wat Pa Phong when that started out, and then later on he became the abbot of Wat Manachat in Thailand for 15 years, and for the last 10 years he's been the abbot of Ajahn Chah's monastery in California, in Northern California, Abhayagiri Monastery. And before we start, please, if I can ask everyone to turn off your mobile phones, if you haven't already done so. Otherwise, it's really bad karma when a person's just about becoming enlightened and your mobile phone stops them. So be careful. So now we can actually hand over to Ajahn Pasano to lead the meditation session today.
Okay. The sort of the modern world's sort of beginning instruction to meditation is to turn off your mobile phone. In Thailand, I've been in Thailand the last year and retreat, and I would do a bit of teaching, and now you actually have to tell people to turn both their phones off. There. Usually these days people don't go around with just one phone. So with that that kind of busyness going on in the mind, or the external world, and the mind becomes that kind of busy. In meditation, I mentioned last night, I think it's always good to remind ourselves that one of the things that we need to be attending to is just turning attention to stillness and directing attention to that quality of stillness within the mind. It's fairly easy to end up making meditation another activity, another thing that the mind gets busy about, obsesses with. But this is really the time to direct attention to stillness, to quality of silence. And it doesn't mean that one won't have any thoughts at all, or the mind won't move at all, but it's just not allowing one's attention to be drawn into that. And that takes a certain willingness to just adjust one's attention, shifting one's attention, so that you're paying attention or attending to something different. Because the habit of the mind is to our attention gets drawn into movement, sort of, I'm sitting here, and the wind, there's a window behind me, like out the front of the monastery. And what first draws my attention, there's trees out there, the wind is blowing, and what draws the attention is the leaves and the branches moving. And that's just natural, that our attention gets drawn to movement, to content, to things. So in meditation, we're trying to reorganize, restructure, kind of reform the way that we pay attention, and to pay attention to stillness, to pay attention to quiet within the mind, the silence within the mind. So as we pay attention, say just using the breath, to pay attention to, say, both the breath, obviously, but then also, again, not as an activity, but as a cycle, which there's this part of the cycle is the movement, and part of the cycle is the stillness. You breathe in, and there's a natural sensation that we experience of the breath touching the tip of the nose or the movement in the body. So to attend to that, to see it clearly, but then also to pay attention to when it's still, it stops. Pay attention to the stillness that surrounds the breath. Again, we get drawn into the activity, the movement, and we sometimes forget to recognize that quality of stillness and silence that is a part of our experience in this present moment. And it gets overrided with the movement, chatter, feeling maybe even conflicting feelings of what we're experiencing. But to again, you're returning attention to that which is still, that which is silent. And by recognizing that, then one's undermining certain qualities that tend to obstruct peace, obstruct clarity, and those are, when we recollect the hindrances to meditation, sense desire, ill will, drowsiness, dullness, restlessness, doubt. Those are qualities that obstruct, agitate, kind of the possibility of stillness and settledness that is a part of the experience of the mind, the heart. So that rather than, and obviously we have to develop skillful means to work with and deal with those hindrances, but also just learning how to attend to when hindrances aren't there. It's like recognizing that there is the possibility of stillness, or within that, within the whole range of all our experience, there's also stillness, there's clarity, there's silence, and to direct attention to that. Now, and that can be very, very powerful, because the Buddha talked about the kind of nutriment or support for basic ignorance, not a lack of knowledge of the true nature of things, avijja. And I think our natural tendency is to think of ignorance as something quite solid and fundamental and almost immovable. It's sort of there all the time. It has always been there. Feels like it's always going to be there. But to recognize that ignorance, that lack of true knowledge, is something that is being supported. And it's being supported by the five hindrances. That's what the Buddha pointed to. So that when we pay attention to the quality of stillness, silence, clarity, it's a direct undermining of ignorance. It's a direct undermining of that lack of true knowledge, and opens a doorway very directly to a perception of possibility of true knowledge. So not to overlook the simplicity of being attentive to things that are already right here, just in this present moment, as we're sitting here paying attention, one can be attending to the quality of stillness, silence, clarity, and it'll shift and change, but bringing attention back, allowing attention to dwell in that quality of stillness. And by paying attention to it, you realize that it's possible. And then you're directly kind of subverting our tendency to confusion, avijja, ignorance. So that this meditation, even though it's a very simple activity, it has very profound implications. And to take that opportunity to attend in this way, and to not just be drawn into the habit of turning to movement and busyness within the mind. So this next period of meditation, just experiment with that. Just gently returning to stillness, appreciating that quality of silence. Allow the mind to brighten with that. give the opportunity people to ask questions if they like.
What type of meditation do you think is most popular in the United States? Zazen Pasno is a teacher in the United States, quite well known.
Oh.
And what are the most popular, what's the most problems, the biggest problem is they have in the United States meditation?
Okay. Probably the most popular meditation. It's hard. I'm actually kind of. I don't really actually know all that much of what's going on in the States. You know, in terms of being in a monastery and being. It's such a big place. In the San Francisco Bay Area, probably the most popular type of meditation is Vipassana. Of course, Vipassana, there's all sorts of competing schools of that. But the of the kind of spirit rock, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein style of meditation. And so there's a lot of interest in that. But there's absolutely everything available in particularly the San Francisco Bay Area.
What's the weirdest type of meditation you've heard about?
There's lots of weird and wonderful things happening in California, but I think they tend to, everything is sort of either, Zen and such, or meditation and such. So it's the incorporation of trying to make everything compatible with meditation or with the ideal. And I think that's probably the most confusing thing that people find is there's no real simple clarity, and the nature of America is it's trying to incorporate absolutely everything. It's trying to sort of honor every tradition and every methodology, and I think that's what gets really confusing. So that the simplicity of Theravada practice, the kind of integrity that Theravada practice, in particular, as Ajahn Chah taught it and set the example. I think that's one of the things that draws a lot of interest to our monastery, and I think probably in Perth here, you're quite blessed with having the sort of the presence of Ajahn Brahm Wangso and the tradition here for many years, so it set a tone that cuts through a lot of the confusion. So I think the thing that is one of the things to be really watching out for is that, because it's on a logical basis, it really feels like we should be trying to accommodate all sorts of different types of view or different types of practice, but what that tends to do is just overload the mind with information and technique, and it's, you know, there's obviously a line that we need to be careful of so that we don't turn into fundamentalist Buddhists, but the sense of just really trying to deepen your experience with one particular approach so that you've got a good base to stand on for reflecting and investigating and seeing how, well, what's the value of other practices? What's the value of other teachings? What's the value of other methodologies? I think that's something to, especially in the West where everything is new, but because everything's new, sometimes they've got a limited shelf life there, and so there's different techniques or fads or ideas of practice get cycling through, and it's really good to come back to have a basic foundation in practice and a simple practice that grounds you in awareness and attention. Also, it's not to be overlooked how important the value of precepts are, meditation, precepts, virtue, integrity. Those are things that really lay the foundation. It was interesting when Ajahn Chah went to America, before he left, he'd been talking about, of course, meditation and the interest in meditation and how much, and discussing a bit with other, the rest of us as Westerners before he went to America and the importance of meditation. And when he actually got to America, and this is, of course, quite a few years ago, and it probably it certainly applies still today, that what he saw and felt made him put a lot of attention on precepts, on virtue, on just really grounding your life in principles that help to keep that foundation solid. Because when that foundation is solid, then you can take a meditation practice or experiment with awareness or experiment with a teaching, and you've got a base to work from, and that helps to cut through a tremendous amount of confusion. Well, I mean, it's a word that's not really used. I mean, it's sort of it's coined, and then is used in different ways. So, when we refer to vipassana, then what we're referring to is a particular aspect of meditation that's about reflection, investigation. And when it's used in general, in terms of as I see it in America anyway, then it's referring to a particular technique, and then there's actually several different techniques that call themselves vipassana, and it's not really being used say the way that traditionally it's used in Theravada Buddhist practice. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but it's or that they're teaching something completely out of the way off the track. But it's actually using it as a technique, and I think that can be confusing because it's your technique is there's a whole range of meditations that the Buddha himself taught, and they all help to lay that basis of training so that the mind can go towards insight. What vipassana literally means sort of insight, seeing clearly. And when it's explained and talked about, then the insight is into impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. But to call it a technique is not quite how it was originally meant to be used. So that the different techniques that they, of course, there's sort of Goenka style vipassana, and then there's Burmese style vipassana, and in Burmese style vipassana, then there's several types of technique, so it gets confusing for people. So I think it's important to realize that coming back to the basis of what's the basis of insight? The basis of insight is having a calm mind, a settled mind, so that you can see the true nature of things. It's not just a one method. It's a way that the mind turns so that you can see things clearly, and then let go, not be entangled in that. Yeah, it's very much that's the tendency, is to be looking for something new, and there's always the new improved model that's coming, that's either out now or is going to be coming out, so then the mind's always going to that. And again, the same thing works in spiritual practice, because that's what we're conditioned to. I think one of the Ajahn Chah, his I think some of the best advice he ever gave us was always just to just keep practicing, whether it's going good and things are going very well, you're getting peaceful states, whatever, and just to keep practicing. Things are going terrible, you think it's all falling apart. it's all bleak and hopeless, just to keep practicing. Because what we really learn, is not a state of mind through a particular technique, but it's like the mind really changes as we keep practicing and training. And the change is, again, it's not I get a particular state of mind and then I've got it, but it's like, no, the kind of the way we view things, the way we relate to things, the way we don't feel compelled to be seeking something different, new, better, is what gives a far greater strength and stability in our practice. It's interesting that there's a discourse where the Buddha talks about the characteristics of the noble ones, and the Arya, those who are have achieved some sort of level of realization, and it's about contentment. It's framed speaking about monastics, but it applies to everybody really, because there's this contentment with robes, contentment with food, contentment with lodging, and contentment is one with whatever one experiences or receives, and one content with not to seek other things that are better, not to be averse to what one gets, but the underlying quality is one of contentment. And then the delight in the relinquishing of the unwholesome and delight in the cultivation of the wholesome, the good. And for each of those, whether that contentment, those three areas of our life, clothing, food, shelter, and the delight in the relinquishing the unskillful and developing the wholesome, is that one doesn't raise up oneself or put down others because of those good qualities. And that's the characteristic of somebody who's really entered the Dhamma. And I always find that really inspiring for myself, because it's not, a state-based achievement. It's a real attitude and fundamental stability of the heart, which is not seeking anything else. It's not trying to get something new, different, and then not comparing oneself to others or things around one because of that.